Hello, my name is Charles M. Province. My friends call me Mike. I am the founder and president of the General George S. Patton Jr. Historical Society. The society was begun in 1970. The initial purpose when I started the society was simply to honor the man who, in my honest opinion, never did receive a great amount of attention at the time that he really wanted it. Yes, I know everybody said he was a megalomaniac and he was a prima donna, but in fact, he probably deserved all of that because he was such a great man. He was not just a general. At any other point in time, 300 or 400 or 500 years back in history, he would probably have been one of the great men in all of history. Patton was a man of rather contradictory characteristics, as a matter of fact. He was a noted horseman, a polo player. He was a well-known champion swordsman. He was even in the 1912 Olympics, and during the Olympics, he had given the French champion the only defeat that he had received. He was a competent sailor, a sportsman. He was an amateur poet. Some years ago, there was a fellow came out with a book just specifically on Patton and his poetry. He was unpredictable in his actions, but he was always dependable. You knew that he was going to do what he was told to do, and he would do it right. He was outgoing, yet at times he was introverted. History proves him to be one of the most complex and possibly paradoxical figures ever to exist. He's mostly remembered for his unique brand of leadership. It was a role that he cultivated and fully exercised. Very often, his daughters would catch him in the bathroom in front of the mirror, and he would be giving strange faces to himself, and they would say, "Daddy, what are you doing?" And he'd say, "I'm practicing my war face. So when I go to war, I want those sons of bitches to be scared of me, by God." He managed to obtain a supreme effort from his men because he knew what it was like to be in battle. He knew what it was like to be in danger. He was scared himself, and he knew that going into battle was one of the most frightening things you could do. Not only are you in a foreign country, not only are you possibly tired and hungry, you haven't had sleep, and people are trying to shoot you, too. He had had the same problems in World War I. He had been in a ditch, and he just happened to look up into the sky and in the clouds. He thought that he had seen, or he said he had seen, whichever way you want to take it. He said he had seen the figures of his forebears, and they were looking down on him, and they were shamefully looking at him, saying, "Georgie, Georgie, there you are lying down in that ditch and you're going to die like a cowardly son of a bitch. Why don't you get up and at least die like a brave man?" And he said he stopped shaking and he shook it off, and that was it. And then he went on, and of course he won the battle that day. And that's what it's all about. It's not necessarily being afraid in battle. It's being able to control your fear. And that's what life is all about. Life from the time you're born until the time you die. Life is just one constant battle. And if you give in, then you're lost. If you give in to the fear, then you're lost. What you have to do is constantly stand up and fight back. All of this pretty much was built into him a little bit earlier. Benjamin Davis Wilson was General Patton's great-grandfather. Benjamin Davis Wilson was also called by the Mexicans in early California Don Benito. Benjamin Davis Wilson was a trapper who had left Tennessee, worked his way over to California. He was a mountain man. He was a trapper. He had fought bears and all sorts of things. It was, if you look at some of the old stories about Davy Crockett, well, Benjamin Davis Wilson was the type of Davy Crockett, if not more so. It was he, not President Wilson, after whom Mountain Wilson in California was named. It was Benjamin Davis Wilson who actually created the citrus industry, the orange industry in California. He built the Episcopal Church of Our Savior in San Gabriel before it was San Gabriel. It was the same church where George S. Patton, after being born, was taken in and baptized. The same church where today there is a stained glass window to honor General George S. Patton. There is a 8-foot or 9-foot bronze statue of General George S. Patton. Also in the graveyard next to the church, there's the monument to Don Benito Wilson. There's also the graves of General Patton's father, George Patton, his mother, and his aunt, and his sister. George Patton was actually called George Patton Jr., but in fact he was the third in the line. But because of the Civil War and things that happened there, there was a break in the line, so he was called the second, or the junior. The Pattons actually regarded themselves as genteel Virginians. Their lineage, they say, was traced back to George Washington and beyond that to a king of England and a king of France. Reportedly, the Pattons were supposed to have had at least 16 signers of the England's Magna Carta that were somehow related to them. After the Civil War, George's father, being a young man, realized that there was very little, if anything, left for them down there. So he packed up and moved to California. And when he moved to California, he met the daughter of Don Benito Wilson, Benjamin Davis Wilson. And they got married, and their son was George S. Patton, Jr. And from that time on, the father taught the son how to ride, taught him how to fish, taught him how to do everything that a man should know how to do. And he learned how to be a man. One of the problems, again, like I said, was General Patton, they think now, suffered from dyslexia. And because of that fact, General Patton didn't go to school until he was about 11 or 12 years old. He stayed at home, and his father and mother read to him. They read from the Bible. They read from the classics. They read from Virgil and Homer and all of the great classics about history and Greek warfare and Spartans and all sorts of things like that. And what happened was, all of this stuck in his head. And then when he did go to school at Stephen Cutter Clark School, which was in Pasadena at the time, it was quite interesting to see this young man, about 12 years old, standing up in front of the class, who could neither read nor write, even though his classmates could read or write, yet he could stand up there and he could spout volumes from the Bible. He could spout volumes from Virgil. He could spout volumes from Shakespeare. He would do it with great dramatic flair, too. Even at 12 years old, he was quite the actor. After going to Pasadena, General Patton went to the Virginia Military Institute. Now, at VMI, he only spent 1 year there. And the reason he only spent 1 year there was because his father was in the background, and he was working feverishly with the California senators and representatives trying to secure a place for George Patton at West Point. And it took him about a year to do so. But finally, when it happened, he had spent a year at VMI, so he knew what it was like to be a plebe. Actually, Patton probably had about 3 years of being a plebe, which is pretty rough. He was at VMI for a year, and then he went to West Point. And the first year as a plebe was really rough for him. He had a lot of trouble getting into the track. And because of his reading disabilities, he had major problems there, too. Yet, the interesting thing about all this is that he persevered, no matter what. He knew that he had to do this, so he kept up until he did it. After the year was over, he had failed his mathematics exam by 0.1%. Now, why this is, I don't know, and I've never been able to track it down, but there is the story that for some reason, if you failed a certain exam, then for some other reason you had to take another exam. And although he had previously passed his French exams, he had to take them again because he had failed the other exams. So he went back for the French exams, and he again failed that one by just about 0.1%. And they were going to kick him out. But he went forward and he asked them for special permission, and because he was such a military type individual, they decided to give him a second chance. So the following year he came back to West Point again as a plebe. Now you can imagine that now you're at West Point and all the people who you were with the previous year are one grade ahead of you, and all the people you're with this year know that, so you have to work even harder. So anyway, it took him about 5 years to get through West Point. But once he got through, then he did graduate, and he was West Pointer, and he was on his way. After West Point, at which he graduated 46th in the class of 103, which isn't too bad for a person with dyslexia. He had actually held the rank of cadet corporal, sergeant major, and the adjutant of his class. He won his school letter by breaking a school record in the hurdles event. He had tried to break records and to play football and baseball, but when he was playing football, he broke his nose twice. He broke both arms, and they quit letting him play football after that because he was just too adamant about it. He just put too much into it, and he would hurt himself. But he was good at track, so that's where he got his letter. Upon graduation, he chose the cavalry because he thought it would be an exciting way to go into the army. After graduating and becoming cavalry officer, he met a young lady, or actually he had met this young lady way back when she was just about a little 12 or 13-year-old girl. The Ayer family had property back in California. He had met Beatrice when she was just a child and almost instantly fell in love with her. And it kind of bothered him for the rest of his life because he knew that when she grew up, even though, of course, you can't marry someone when they're 12 or 13, but he knew that there was something special about this girl. And all through his career at West Point, she kept coming down to visit him, and after they finally got married, then they started their own family. Her father was against the marriage because he didn't like the idea of a man being in the military. He didn't like the idea of a soldier being married to his daughter. So Patton wrote a letter to her father one day and explained to him that he could not explain why, but for some reason it was just as natural for him to be a soldier as anything else. And if he couldn't be a soldier, then he had no reason to live. Therefore, that was what he wanted to do, and that was what he wanted to be. And her father acquiesced, and then they got married. Later on in 1912, Patton attended the Olympics held at Stockholm, Sweden. That was the same year that Jim Thorpe was given all the medals. Patton competed in the modern pentathlon, the military pentathlon, they called it then. And the events included pistol shooting, a 300-meter swim, fencing, a steeplechase, and a cross-country foot race. He finished a very respectable fifth place. What was interesting was, during the trials for the pistol shooting, he had set a record. Yet, whenever they actually had the day of competition, they said that he had missed one of the targets. Now, the story goes that actually, when they looked at the target, his pattern of shots was so close that very probably one of the bullets went through one of the other holes or close to it, and they couldn't discern that there was another hole missing there. So that's the problem. They couldn't see all of the holes, so they assumed that he had missed, even though he had set a record just the previous day for his shooting. And that pushed him down. So otherwise, had he not gotten that, he would have won. He would have gotten a gold medal for the Olympics for that year. After the games, and at his own expense, Patton and his wife traveled to the French cavalry school located in Saumur, France. He was going to take lessons from the fencing instructor there. While they were also there, Beatrice was not only fluent in French, she wrote and read French extremely well, of course. And what she did was she helped him to take the French manuals and take the parts that he wanted and then rewrite them into English so that later, when he got back to the States, he wrote the entire manual for swordsmanship and for cavalry, for using swords in the U.S. Army. He then purposefully cultivated his own reputation as a swordsman, and he later designed the saber that the United States cavalry adopted. It was called the M1913 saber. So actually what happened at this point was he got one of his first nicknames. He had a number of nicknames long before he had the blood and guts nickname that someone had erroneously given him during the Second World War. Some reporter had misheard or apparently didn't like the fact that Patton had simply said, it takes blood and brains to win a war. And he, whoever that reporter was, changed it around and called it blood and guts. So that's what stuck. But before that, At the time that Patton had created his M1913 Sabre, he was then called Sabre George, and that was an interesting thing for a very young second lieutenant in the Army to have a great distinction like that. The Sabre itself was an interesting idea. It showed exactly what his whole concept was and would remain to be his concept through the entire history and career of his Army days. What he wanted to do was teach men, instead of taking the curved saber they had before and trying to hack men to death, you would take the saber, hold it in your arm, extend your arm, lay down on your horse's neck at a full gallop, and then as a full complete weapon, you, your horse, and your saber fully extended and pointed, whenever you hit your opponent, that was pretty much it. Your opponent was dead. There was no question about it. And as he would tell his men, says, don't worry about whether or not you're going to disengage with the enemy. You just, as you go forward, you'll automatically bring your hand down, and the sword designed with the rivulets, the blood rivulets on both sides, it will automatically disengage and pull from the enemy. Therefore, you can go on and get the next man in line. And that was his whole concept. Straightforward, direct. That was the way that you won battles. When he was assigned to the cavalry school at Fort Riley, Kansas, he then took over the instruction of the cavalry course. He instructed his men both in the use of the new saber he designed, and he instructed them in horsemanship too. At this time, he was given an impressive title that was called the Master of the Sword. He was the very first to hold the newly created title. It was quite a bit for a young second lieutenant. In March of 1916, Pancho Villa raided the town of Columbus, New Mexico. They killed a total of 17 American citizens. They had actually crossed the border. They had committed an act of war. And then sometimes people today wonder why Americans went down to Mexico. They forget the fact that they had committed an act of war. In response to the raid, General John J. Pershing, called Blackjack Pershing, organized a punitive expedition to pursue Villa into Mexico. It is said at the time that Pershing had already put together his staff, and they were getting ready to go, and when Patton heard about it, he wanted to know why he couldn't go along. So what he did was, he just simply camped out on General Pershing's doorstep, and every single time the general would come or go, he would see Patton, and Patton would stand and salute and say, "Sir, requesting permission to go." And finally, Pershing realized, well, I guess if he wants to go that bad, he may have some good attributes about him. During May, Patton was in charge of a 15-man contingent traveling in 3 Dodge touring cars. The purpose for the trip was to buy corn from Mexican farmers for the American soldiers. Patton supposedly was relying purely on a hunch. And what he did then, he led a little raid at a place called the Rubio Ranch. He believed that one of Villa's men might be there. As it turned out, not one, but 3 of the enemy were actually there. And during their attempted escape, Patton and his men engaged them in a lively skirmish. All 3 of the bandits were killed. Patton personally was responsible for dispatching 2 of them. And that's why on his Colt 45 with the ivory handles, not pearl handles, on his Colt 45 he put 2 notches. He had personally, as a soldier, dispatched 2 enemy. He had killed 2 men with that gun. That gun, if you ever want to see it, by the way, is on display with the other gun that he carried, the Smith & Wesson 357 Magnum. They're both on display at the Patton Museum at Fort Knox, Kentucky. It's a wonderful museum, beautiful place. After the bandits had been taken care of, Patton triumphantly strapped the bodies onto the motor cars, 1 on each hood. He then took them directly to Pershing's headquarters for identification. He created quite a commotion there. He had gone in and broken up a meeting that Pershing was having, and Pershing was really not very happy because he didn't like people coming in and interrupting him when he was doing something. But Patton said, "Sir, if you please come outside here, you'll see why I'm bothering you." And then when Pershing walked out and saw the 3 bandits strapped on there like dead deer that had been shot as trophies, then he realized what he had on his hands there. And it was interesting, too, because Lieutenant Patton immediately became a national hero. This was one of the things that kind of started his desire for fame, I suppose, because he had become a national hero. Newspapers in the United States had carried stories about his exploits, and for a full week he had his picture in the papers all over the United States. Stories were mentioned where his name was prominent all over the United States, and it was quite an interesting time for the young man. If you look back in history, there are certain things that happen at certain times, and you don't really realize what they are at the time until you get past. That's something that General Patton had always tried to instill in his men. Especially when you look back into Mexico, you realize that General Patton, as a lieutenant, was actually involved in the very first motorized engagement in history. He had taken motorized warfare to the enemy, and he had dispatched the enemy, and then he had, with motorization, he had taken the bodies back, of course, and showed Pershing. One of the problems Patton had in Mexico was that there really wasn't much to do, other than the fact that they had the firefight, and he became a national hero for a period of time. Mexico duty was really pretty rough. It was hot, it was dirty, it was boring, it was monotonous. But Patton being Patton, he always wanted to make the best of every situation. So what he did in his off hours, he always studied General Pershing. And what he did in the next few years, he started to try to take the better qualities of Pershing and put them into his personality, yet retain his personality and his focus for combat. When Pershing assumed command of the American Expeditionary Force going to France in World War I, because he had known Patton and he had known what he had done, he took Patton with him, of course. Now, the problem again was Patton was stuck in the headquarters office with Pershing, and it was a boring, tiresome office job. At that time, a fellow by the name of Swinton, who was an Englishman, he created what was called a tank. And the tank and the whole concept of tank warfare became a very interesting concept to General Patton. He realized if this were done correctly, then we could take this tank and we could actually use our cavalry tactics for speed and boldness and put it into the tank corps, and then we could really make something out of this. He knew that the tanks were not only new, they were also unreliable. They were unwieldy, and they were unproven instruments of warfare. But he knew that if you did it right, if you could take these tanks and really come up with a good tactic, a good concept, and use them correctly, then they would be something special. Patton was then assigned as the very first officer to the United States Tank Corps. Why he was not given complete control of it, I don't know, but at the time he was only a colonel, and of course, as always, they wanted a general in charge of something, so they found a general and put him in charge of it and put Patton under him. But Patton was actually the one who ran the tank corps. Patton almost single-handedly formed the American Tank School. He wrote the training manuals. He devised the training doctrine and methodologies. He wrote the seminal paper, which became the basis for the United States Tank Corps. He taught and trained his tankers, and he eventually led them into combat. The paper that he wrote, as a matter of fact, I have a copy of it, and on the very front of the paper, he, in his own handwriting, wrote down that this is the best technical paper I ever wrote, and it was, in fact, the basis for the entire United States Tank Corps. On the first day of the Meuse-Argonne offensive, Patton was very nearly killed. A bullet struck him in the upper leg, passed completely through him, and on its exit, it ripped out a large piece of flesh from his buttock. It tore a large hole in the rear of his lower cheek. But Patton, again, being Patton, in spite of his profuse bleeding, he kept advancing until the loss of blood forced him to stop. He was then luckily evacuated to a rear echelon hospital before he bled to death on the battlefield. It was the final combat that he would see during World War I. And unfortunately, as a birthday present, the armistice was signed on his birthday, November 11th, which eventually became Veterans Day. Patton used to always joke about his wound, and very often during parties, if he had had a little too much to drink, he was more than happy to drop his drawers and show people where the wound was. And very often, of course, what he would do it just simply to get a rise out of people. He wanted to see how people would react to some of the things he would say and some of the things he would do. When he would do that, he would drop his drawers, he would show people his wound, and then he would brag about being a half-assed general. After the armistice was signed, Patton returned to the United States as an officer of the Tank Corps. But shortly after that, because the Tank Corps was being pretty much ignored by Congress, they had no money, he returned to the cavalry because the cavalry was his first love. The major reason, of course, for his departure from the Tank Corps was the stinginess of the United States Congress, which is a continual thing. If you look at what's happened after World War I, after World War II, after Korea, after almost every war we've been involved in, they think that that's the end of it, and then they cut back and they destroy the military. But anyway, after Congress allotted a total of $500 for a full year's worth of research and development for the Tank Corps, Patton realized that during the years of peace there would be no American development of the tank. And he was absolutely correct. It was other people who would develop the tank. In the early 1930s, Patton did not remain static, of course. While he was stationed at Pearl Harbor, he wrote a very highly prophetic discussion paper. Its subject matter dealt with the possibility of an air attack by the Japanese against the Hawaiian Islands. Patton held the firm opinion that Japan had explicit and definite ideas about domination of the Pacific Basin. His paper outlined almost exactly the plan that was used by the Japanese on December 7, 1941. He had written the paper, he had given it to the G2 intelligence officer, and apparently it had been just stuffed away somewhere, filed, and never looked at. In 1939, of course, things begin to happen. Hitler had taken over Germany. The Sudetenland had been taken. Austria had been taken. By 1939, Poland was in distress. Patton was then assigned to the 2nd Armored Brigade, stationed at Fort Benning, Georgia. His skillful management of the 2nd Brigade soon prompted his being given command of the entire 2nd Armored Division. He was soon considered to be, again, America's leading tank expert. It was the second time that he had had to prove himself for this, but he did it, as always. In 1942, General Patton was assigned the task of creating the Desert Training Center, called the DTC, in the Mojave Desert. The Desert Training Center incorporated most of the Mojave Desert, and it was everywhere between perhaps the southern middle half of California, all the way through Arizona, up into Nevada. Actually, the whole Desert Training Center, the area in mileage alone, acreage, was larger than the United Kingdom, Great Britain. But General Patton was out there, and he figured that what I'm going to do is, since we're going to invade North Africa, our men had better know what it's like to be in the desert. So he went to the desert and he trained his men. At best, it was about 115 or 120 degrees outside the tanks, so you can imagine what it was like inside the tanks. The men were given a gallon of water a day, and they were told you can shave with it, you can drink it, you can do whatever you want to with it, but that's all you're getting. And he spent a lot of his time out at the DTC creating the U.S. tank doctrine and tactics that were going to be used in North Africa. And by the time they got ready, and by the time they were overseas and at North Africa, they were glad to be in North Africa. It was easier there than it was under Patton at the DTC. There were rattlesnakes. There were scorpions. It was hot. It was dusty. It was pretty nasty weather. If you want to see a little history about the Desert Training Center, if you go to Indio, California, or if you're in Indio, California, and you head due east on Highway 10, about 35 miles later, and you can't miss it if there's nothing else there, there is a place called the General Patton Memorial Museum. Very often people will ask, well, why in the world did they put a Patton Museum out there? And that's exactly the reason, because General Patton was the one who created the Desert Training Center, and that is where Camp Young was located. Camp Young, of course, was the headquarters for the entire Desert Training Center. After General Patton left, General Walton Walker had taken over command of the area, and after he had trained his men, took them over to England and then onto the continent, he became the commanding general of the 20th Corps, which was under Patton's Third Army. And General Walton Walker's men were also called the Ghost Corps, the 20th Corps, which also spearheaded the entire Third Army during the Second World War. So there's a lot of history out there at that museum. In the spring of 1943, after the disastrous American defeat at Kasserine Pass in Tunisia, Patton was given command of the 2nd Corps. In customary Patton fashion, he not only took command, he grabbed it by the throat. He let people know exactly what was going on and who was in charge. Patton quickly straightened out the disorganized American units, led them to victory at El Guitar, and then turned over command of the Corps to his deputy commander, Omar Bradley. As commanding general of the 7th Army, General Patton and his soldiers stole the glory that General Montgomery so badly wanted. Hampered by higher echelon, sparse supplies, and forced to use secondary roads, in spite of all that, Patton and the 7th Army still managed to reach Messina first. Now, this is something in the movie that you'll notice, that they have Patton and all of his men and the tanks and everything there. In fact, that's not really true. They did beat them to Messina, but they got there just a little bit before, maybe a few hours before. The slapping incidents. Every time I think about this, I just think how silly it is. When they were at the front, if a man turned tail and ran, that's one of the reasons why officers had 45s on them. Men were actually shot at the front because of cowardice. Nobody asked questions. Yet one man slaps a couple of soldiers, and they almost ruin his career over that. Which is interesting, because the Russians certainly would never care about that. And the Germans just absolutely could not believe that just because a general was a little upset and he got a little emotional and he struck someone, that they would actually take him out of combat because of that. At any rate, there were two men slapped, not just one. And it's interesting to note that during the slapping incidents, one of the men, believe it or not, had left his unit without permission. He had gone on sick call without permission. He was, in fact, AWOL at the time. No one knew where he was. He was just sitting there waiting for someone to ask him what his problem was. And that's one of the men that, unfortunately, Patton came in contact with. So the fact of the matter is, because the man was AWOL, they could have court-martialed him, they could have stood him up and shot him as a deserter, but that never came to light. The other man had had major problems. He had run away a number of times anyhow, and Patton never really, if we want to get technical, like they get technical in the courtrooms today, Patton never really did slap the men. He struck them with his gloves. He personally never came into contact with them. But both of these guys who were slapped, they were what he called malingerers. Now let's back up here just a second and also give you a little background on General Patton. General Patton had been receiving reports that some of the men, upon landing in Sicily, had been taking off their uniforms and throwing them away, getting clothes from some of the locals and trying to act like they were part of the inhabitants of the island. he was getting reports, which may sound humorous on the front, but really is not very humorous, that back in the old days, the U.S. Army used to manufacture their own soap. Now, an interesting thing about the soap was if you cut off a sliver of it and forced it up your rectal cavity, for some strange reason, it would not hurt you, not affect you anything in any way, other than it would raise your temperature of your body to about 102, 103 degrees. So men were doing that and then going on sick call to get out of combat duty. Patton himself was suffering from the flu. He was running without without the assistance of any soap. He was actually running a fever of about 103. He was working 16-hour days. He was trying to change things around so that the American Army was not something that was just there to help out the British Army and Montgomery, but they were their own force and getting their own headlines. And during all of this, he walks into a place where he sees men who have been blinded, men who have their hands gone, men who are dying, men who have half a head left, men with blood all over them. And then he walks up to this other man and he says, "What are you here for?" And the guy says, "I just can't take it." Patton was Patton. Everybody knew the way George Patton was. Everybody knew how George Patton acted and reacted. Why was it such a big surprise when he acted the way he did? He hauled off and slapped the guy with his gloves. Actually, both of them he did. He had given orders previously that these malingerers, as he called them, these so-called shell-shocked soldiers, were not to be allowed in these areas where men were wounded. He had given specific and direct orders they were to be kept separate and apart from everyone else. Those orders were not followed. One of the commanding officers, who was a doctor in charge of the hospitals over there, was actually a reserve officer, and he had a great dislike for Patton in the first place. He personally didn't care whether that order was followed or not. He could have been court-martialed for not following that specific order. And then what happens is the man in charge, I think it was a Colonel Bless was his name, he wrote up a report on this, chastising Patton. He sent the report off, and of course it went through the normal echelons, and it ended up with General Bradley. General Bradley didn't even bother to show this report to General Patton so he could see what was happening, and he could be aware that someone was actually reporting this. He locked it away in his safe. So Patton was unaware that this report had been filed. Then, after it all broke loose, the only reason it really came to fruition was because of Drew Pearson. The people, or some people rather, not to make a blanket statement, some people in the United States, and especially the newspaper community, decided to believe this so-called muckraker instead of believing what was really going on over in Sicily. And at the time, too, to add to the problems, General Patton, here he was fighting for so-called freedom, yet he was given a direct order by General Eisenhower to shut up. He was not allowed to talk about it. He was not allowed to explain it. He was not allowed to do anything. He was just simply told to dummy up and sit back, and that was it. He couldn't even talk. He didn't even have the right to free speech. The only thing that happened was Patton was chastised. He was made to apologize. And even when he went out on these apologies, very often the units didn't want to hear them. He would stand up in front of, for example, the 3rd Division, and the 3rd Division wouldn't hear it. He started to apologize, and they started shouting him down. They said, "We don't want to hear it. We don't want to hear it." Because they knew what kind of a man General Patton really was. And at the end of every chapter of my book, The Unknown Patton, I have a little piece from the Associated Press or some newspaper clipping about General Patton, and one of them is titled, "Soldier Says Patton Can Kick, Slap, or Slug Him Anytime." And he goes on to say in there that he knows General Patton is the damnedest best fighter there is. And as far as he's concerned, Patton can come over and slap him anytime he wants because he knows that Patton is the best damn general there is. And he knows that he's going to get him home safe and he's going to get him home as fast as he possibly can. So much for the slapping incidents. In the spring of 1944, Patton sailed to England on the Queen Mary. The Queen Mary was built by the Cunard White Star Company, was pressed into military service as a troop transport for most of World War II. It was called the Grey Ghost because they had to repaint it gray, and then they would slip through they would go the northern route, so they would catch a lot of fog, and that way they could transport a lot of people at one time. Once disembarked on the continent, Patton and Third Army, or what he called Lucky Forward as their code name. Patton always believed in luck. He told his men that when you're born, it's just like being dealt a hand. You're dealt so much luck, and you either use it up or you don't. If you don't go out and test it, you'll never use it up. If you do go out and test it, then you'll use up what you have, and when you run out, well, then you're out of luck, and that's too bad. That's the way it's meant to be. That's fate. After the Third Army had finally landed on and started out officially on the 1st of August, 1944, they attacked, again, like the old cavalrymen with three arms. They attacked in all directions. They drove south, west, east, north, across France. They destroyed everything in their path that was German. They came back up around and stopped at Falaise waiting for the British under Montgomery to close the Argentan-Falaise gap, which he never closed until the German 7th Army managed to escape the bulk of the army. Had they allowed Patton to close that, they could have had the whole entire army cut off. They could have destroyed that whole army right then and there. Very possibly it could have cut off the war by another 3 or 4 months. You never know. In December 1944, the Germans launched what they called the Ardennes Offensive. The Americans called it the Battle of the Bulge. Patton's army made a spectacular battle march to relieve the 101st Airborne's Screaming Eagles, who were holding Bastogne against all odds. Interesting story about that. When Patton was over there, and they knew that something was going on because every single time that the Germans had radio silence, it meant that there was going to be some major operation coming into effect. Well, the Germans had radio silence. General Patton's G2, his intelligence officer, Oscar Koch, Colonel Koch, was probably one of the best, if not the best, intelligence officer in all of the Army at that time. He had made certain specific reports about the area. He had told General Patton about the situation. He had sent a number of communiques to Chaffee headquarters warning Eisenhower that there was something happening in that area. And one of the reasons it was happening is because the First Army, incorrectly, according to military maxims, they had made a rest and recuperation area too close to the front. They were letting their men just simply sit around and do nothing, and the Germans knew it. And General Patton and Koch got together the reports. They sent them to Chaffee. They kept telling them, there's something going on here. You better pay attention up there around Luxembourg, around the Bastogne area. And no one paid attention, of course. And then on the 16th of December, all hell broke loose. The Germans came through. And if it had not been for General Patton, they damn well could have gotten into Antwerp, because the Americans were just simply unprepared for the Germans. Of course, Patton, as always, made the best of the situation, and he was probably one of the few people who really, like a chess player, instead of simply looking at your current move, to play chess properly, you have to look at the board, and you have to consider, if I do this, what's he going to do over there? And if I do that, what's he going to do over there? So what he and Koch did was to sit down with the staff, and they came up with two completely separate, distinct plans. And when Patton went to the meeting with General Eisenhower and Bradley, Patton stood up, and everyone else was pretty much down in the dumps, and Patton was the only one there somewhat jubilant and had a good positive attitude about this. He stood up and said, "Well, Ike, if you let me go, I can have a couple of divisions going in 48 hours. And Ike gave him one of his stares, like he used to say, a stare. And he said, "George, don't be fatuous. This is a very serious situation." And Patton said, "Don't you worry about it. When we left, everything was in order at my house. I have two complete separate plans ready to go." And then he walked up to the map, and he showed exactly, with about a half an hour's presentation, both plans. And what he really wanted to do was let the Germans go ahead for another day or two and get the bulk of their forces beyond the shoulders of the American and Allied armies, and then just chop them off right at the head, the same way they could have done with the German 7th Army, and pretty much ended the war another 2 or 3 months earlier, which again then would have kept the Russians from getting into Berlin and taking most of Germany and eating up half of Europe. But those things don't fit into some of these people's minds. Or as General Patton would say, that's not the way these gentlemen up north fight war. So anyway, Patton's standing up there at the map, and he's going through this, and everyone is just flabbergasted that Patton has such a complete, absolute, total control of this situation, and he knows what's going on. So Eisenhower says, "Well, that sounds okay to me. Go ahead and do it." And within 24 hours, Patton had about 90% of his army turned 90 degrees, heading the other way, north, which, if you look at what goes on within an army, just getting anything to happen at all very often is a major, major thing that takes weeks. But, of course, we're talking about Georgie Patton here. Now, George Patton, by God, he wasn't about to let anybody stop him from doing that, because he knew that this was his personal prime moment of time. This was the epitome of his career, to stand up in front of all the people who looked down upon him and who were promoted above him purely for political reasons, and then show them that he, in fact, was the better man. He was the better general. He was the one who should have been running the show. And, of course, that's the way it went. They went in the Bastogne. They pushed back the bulge. Instead of cutting it off like Patton wanted to, Eisenhower had this big thing about pushing them back on a broad front. Now, when you push back on a broad front, though, if you study tactics at all, anyone with the basic concept of tactics will know that what you need to do is envelopments, a series of small envelopments then become a series of large envelopments. And that's the way you cut off the enemy, or what Patton used to say, you hold them by the nose and you kick them in the ass. In the spring of 1945, after this was all over, Patton's army drove relentlessly into Germany, across the Rhine, finally down into Austria, and at the war's end, his soldiers were in Czechoslovakia and getting ready to go further. Patton and his warriors had given a magnificent performance. Third Army had, in fact, gone farther, faster. They had conquered more territory. They had killed, wounded, and captured more enemy soldiers than any other army in the entire recorded history of war. And then, in December 1945, it was at the end of Patton's luck. December 12th, General Patton was driving along in his 1939 Cadillac. Woody Woodring was driving, and Hobart Gay, his chief of staff and his buddy, were sitting in the back. And General Patton had just reached over to open up his shotgun case, because they were going out pheasant hunting. He had reached over to open up his shotgun case to look at something inside. And a 2.5-ton truck, driven by two guys who had gone out previously the night before, gotten drunk and were still hungover, made an illegal left turn into the Kaserne at Mannheim, Germany. They cut right straight in front of Patton's car. Woody Woodring could not get out of the way, and they smashed into the car. Patton flew forward, since he was leaning forward. He hit his head on the front seat of the car. Well, some people say the front seat, some people say the car actually kind of jumped up a bit because of the fact it hit. And, of course, the momentum on a vehicle will keep it going forward. And some people say that he hit the light on the overhead inside the car. But at any rate, it cut his scalp open, lacerated his scalp, pulled the scalp back about halfway, snapped his head back, and broke the vertebrae in his neck. He was paralyzed at that time, and he never came out of paralysis. They took him into the hospital. They brought in a specialist, and the specialist told him right up front, he said that your neck has been snapped, your vertebrae is broken, you'll probably remain paralyzed the rest of your life. You will never walk. You will never ride a horse again. And then they started doing things to him to at least try to relieve some of the pain and pressure. They took large fish hooks, and these large fish hooks they inserted under the bones, the cheekbones of Patton. They inserted them under the bones underneath, near the base of his neck, underneath his skull, and they put weights on those to try to pull his head back. Luckily, his wife was able to make it over there, and she spent some time with him. And then the end came. He started to do pretty well, but the end came later whenever he said to her, says, it's getting too dark. I mean, too late. And then he went to sleep. She went off to have lunch, and when she came back, he was dead. And General Patton died at 5 minutes before 6 p.m. on December 21st. His body was put on display in Heidelberg in the church. He was put on a train, and he was taken to the American Military Cemetery at Ham, Luxembourg, and he was buried among his men. People often ask, well, why was he buried over there? Why wasn't he brought back home like all officers? General Walker had mentioned to Beatrice that, you know, George always said he wanted to be with his men. So she said, well, of course, that's the simple answer. That's where he should be. So they decided that he would be buried with his men, and to this day, he's the only American general officer buried in a foreign country. Where he was buried among the other 4,000 graves, which still exist there at that cemetery, graves of men who apparently were single or men who just simply didn't have anyone because they were never claimed, their bodies were never claimed, or there was no one to report their deaths to, they're still over there in the foreign country, buried in the country where they fought for the freedom, for the people, for that country. General Patton was buried among the men, but after years went by, so many people started coming by to visit the gravesite that they were actually wearing down all of the grass around the other graves. So they dug Patton up and they moved him toward the head of the cemetery, and now he has his own special place up there, and he is still visited to this day.
I can't see the reason such fine young men get killed. There are so many battles yet to fight.
Battle-weary but victorious, American GIs and Tommies of the British 8th Army meet in a joyful Allied victory celebration at Wadi Akarit in North Africa. For the first time in this war, Broadway and Piccadilly join hands. Meanwhile, General Montgomery, hero of El Alamein, continues to lead his veteran and victorious British 8th Army in a relentless drive against Rommel's vaunted Africa Corps.
Meine Herren, es ist offensichtlich, dass Nordafrika nicht mehr lange zu halten sein wird. Wir müssen den nächsten Schritt des Gegners vorausberechnen. Ich erwarte einen Bericht des Staates innerhalb von 24 Stunden. Ich danke Ihnen.
Herr Steiger, Sie haben kein Wort gesagt.
Es hat mich auch niemand gefragt, Herr General.
Dann frage ich Sie jetzt. Glauben Sie, dass Patton Sardinien angreifen wird?
Nein, Herr General.
Und warum nicht?
Patton ist ein Militärhistoriker.
Er weiß, dass immer schon Sizilien und nicht Sardinien der Ausgangspunkt zur Eroberung Italiens gewesen ist. Wenn Patton zu bestimmen hätte, so würde er in Syrakus auf Sizilien landen. Wie die alten Griechen.
Steiger, wir leben im 20. Jahrhundert.
Aber Sie müssen berücksichtigen, Herr General Obert, dass Patton ein Mann des 16. Jahrhunderts ist. Darf ich vorlesen?
Ja.
In einer stillen Straße in New York, 1922, als sich Patton gerade auf dem Weg zu einem großen Diner befand, sah er, wie drei Männer ein junges Mädchen zwangen, hinten auf einen Lastwagen aufzusteigen. So wie er war, im Frack, sprang er aus seinem Wagen und forderte mit gezogener Waffe die Männer auf, die Frau loszulassen.
Stellte sich später heraus, dass sie mit einem der Männer verlobt war, der lediglich beim Aufsteigen helfen wollte.
Was könnte Aufschlussreicher sein?
Ich weiß nicht, worauf Sie hinaus wollen.
Don Quixote streitet mit 6 Kaufleuten aus Toledo auf der Straße, um Dulcinea Zugen zu verteidigen.
Dulcinea, wer ist denn das?
Herr Generalorist, glauben Sie mir, Patton ist ein romantischer Krieger, der in unsere Zeit verschlagen wurde. Pattons Geheimnis ist die Vergangenheit. Er wird den Angriff auf Sizilien deshalb befürworten, weil die alten Griechen es damals auch so gemacht haben.
One interesting thing about Patton after his death was that, especially when I write of his death, or I talk of his death, I always say he died at the age of 60. I never say he was 60 years old, because Patton, like innumerable great men, was never really old. He was always on the cutting edge. He was always on the cusp of everything new. He tried to do everything he could to get every piece of new technology into his hands so that he could do the best job available from the best materials and tools at hand. Also, it was interesting too that for a man of his age, there were men half his age who just simply could not keep up with him. And people would often ask him why he pushed himself so hard, and his answer was always the same. He said, I'm the commanding general. I'm in charge. If people see me fail, if people see me wear out, then they think the old man's had it. And if I've had it, then the army's had it. And it just rolls downhill. So if I'm not there and I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do and I'm not putting on the proper show, then everything else just falls apart. He was smart enough to know that essentially the commanding general, other than being a titular head, he was also the embodiment of an army. Now, that's interesting in the fact that if you look at history and you read about other people from other armies and other units, people from the First Army, for example, under Hodges, they will tell you, I was with such and such regiment. I was with such and such division. But everybody, invariably, who was in the Third Army, they always say, yeah, I was with Georgie Patton. I was in the Third Army. Then they might mention their division number. They might mention their regiment, the battalion, or whatever. But it's always, I was with Georgie Patton. Because he had a particular stamp that, by God, he put on his men and his army, and it was his army. It's often been voiced by those who knew him well that perhaps it was a good thing for him to die when he did. He died at the pinnacle of his success. He was known for the great things that he had accomplished. During his lifetime, Patton displayed so many different personalities that it sometimes is difficult to know who the real person really was. I've talked to so many people about it, and they say that there really were basically two Pattons. There was Patton the warrior, who was out there in front of everybody, leading the men, trying to get them to do their best in combat. But when Patton was alone with his men, or when he was alone with an individual or a friend, they say invariably that he was a very kind, very quiet man. He was very studious. He was likable. And he always thought of other people. He was very thoughtful of them. Of course, the well-known image was his, what he called his war mask, his toughness and his profanity. His bluster and braggadocio were appurtenances that he assumed simply because he believed that only what he called he-men stimulated other men to fight. In the same way that the Indian had the war cry, the rebel yell, and the paratroopers would jump out of an airplane yelling, Geronimo, it's those same reasons that help men in battle to disguise their fear. Patton's fierceness helped him to disguise and overcome his own personal fear, and to instill that overcoming the fear into his men. Psychologists call these disguises reinforcing factors. And anyone who's ever taught school, or if you know anything about teaching theory, you'll know that once you teach someone something, you have to keep reinforcing that to make sure that it sticks in their head. And that's basically what it is. It's reinforcing the sights and sounds and the other stimuli that start the adrenaline flowing. They spur men into action, and they help the men act against one of their deepest intuitive drives, the urge for self-preservation. It's what keeps a man from throwing down the rifle and running away from the enemy. It's what makes him stand up and face not only the enemy, but also face the fear within himself. The battlefield is indeed a frightening and very often an eerie place. The emotion most prevalent is fear. Fear of disfigurement, fear of disability, and ultimately fear of death. Cultivation of these reinforcing factors is only one of the many ways used by men in battle to overcome their basic fear. That's one thing that Patton did so extremely well. This was the total reasoning behind his acts, his demeanor, and especially his dress. His ivory-handled revolvers, his oversized stars, his tough, blunt, blue-famed profanity were what gave his men in large doses to create the necessary warrior psychology. He gave them the will to confront and to destroy their enemies. These things gave his men the confidence to defeat the enemy, and his gift basically was the gift of leadership. Very often people don't know what leadership is today. They just think because they're promoted to something, they're in charge, everybody's just supposed to do what they say. But in fact, leadership is a vastly different thing. Speaking of the ivory-handled revolvers, of course, brings to mind in the movie where someone refers to his pearl-handled revolvers. And I still hear people say that. And to this day, somebody says pearl-handled revolvers, I always step in just like he did, and I say, no, 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 no. They weren't pearl, they were ivory-handled revolvers. Only a pimp in a cheap New Orleans whorehouse carries around pearl-handled revolvers. Not only did he think that cheap whorehouses were where you found pearl-handled revolvers, he also felt that pearl-handled revolvers were unlucky. If you remember back, for anyone who's ever read about the Wild West, Wild Bill Hickok especially, the man who had the hand of aces and eights, and who usually had his back to the wall, and then the one time he didn't, with his aces and eights, got shot in the back, he had pearl-handled revolvers. And Patton never forgot that. Now, scarcely appreciated today is the fact that Patton, throughout his career, expended vast amounts of time and energy just simply to learn and keep up with the intricacies of his chosen profession and the new technologies available to him at the time. He read enormously, voraciously, endlessly in the literature of warfare and history. Not only was he conversant with the field and technical manuals of his time, he was also familiar with the pages of history. He was indeed a historian. He was a scholar, although he would hate like hell for someone to have that said about him, probably. He wanted to be known as a warrior, not a scholar. He always felt that scholars, unfortunately, were the ones who lived through wars, and therefore anything written about wars always had a kind of a scholarly touch to it because the warriors died, or they were too damn stupid to know how to write. So therefore the warriors never really wrote anything about war. That's one reason that his book, War as I Knew It, is extremely popular even today. I think just last year a new version of it came out in paperback. It's been published, I think in 1947 the original issue came out, and it's been published ever since, and it's still available. It's probably required reading, I would imagine, at a lot of military academies, probably West Point, of course. During Patton's lifetime, he accumulated one of the best military libraries in the world. Today, that library is located at the Military Academy at West Point, New York. Almost the entire library was given as a gift from his son, George S. Patton III, who is a retired United States Army Major General, and he himself a West Point graduate, graduating in 1946. Patton studied the past to discover the great historical continuities. Patton felt that all of recorded history is one contiguous string of accomplishments. Patton understood, and rightly so, that history is not just a record of isolated individual events non-related to each other. Every single act in history is contiguous. That means it is somehow related to some other act that occurs and then reflects upon another act that occurs in the future. Patton recognized this historical cohesiveness and its contiguous correlation for what it is. It is, in fact, the basis for all cultural habit, tradition, custom, and the nature of mankind itself. The main fascination for Patton in his search for the common elements of man's historical behavior was the significance and importance of military leadership. He continually and ceaselessly sought these exclusive factors that produce victory or defeat in battle. He was intrigued by the relationships of tactics and supply, maneuver and shock, weapons and willpower. He could easily lecture on such subjects as scale, chain, and armor, on German mercenaries, the Italian wars, Polish tactics and techniques, the Peninsula War, and so on for hours at a time. Patton wasn't simply cognizant of history, he was familiar and intimate with it. He knew about Greek phalanx, Roman legions, Napoleon's columns, Baron de Homine, Marshal Saxe, Sun Tzu, Flavius Renatus, Jeb Stuart, Mosby's Rangers, Grant, Lee, Sampson, and Sampson's use of the ass's jaw. He knew everything about all the way up to and including the mass armies used in World War I. He could subjectively compare the heavy cavalry of Belisarius with the modern armored vehicle. He discovered a certain craftiness in the 6th century tactics of Belisarius that he actually applied to the use of modern tanks in his time. At the same time, he was both thoughtful and contemplative. However, unlike intellectuals, he believed that the ultimate virtue in action in warfare was action. His officers were often received lectures on the value, advantage and benefits of not only reading but studying history. On numerous occasions, Patton reported to sick call for the treatment of conjunctivitis, an infection and inflammation of the eyes. It was caused, of course, by many nights of non-stop reading. His reading wasn't casual reading either. It was purposeful, intense study. He had many things to learn, and he never stopped learning. He had a habit of making profuse notes in his books, easily and often filling the margins of a page with his own thoughts and concepts. In one particular instance, after finishing a book by General J.F.C. Fuller, and for those who know military history, that's John Frederick Charles Fuller, who was the actual acknowledged father of tank doctrine over in Great Britain, Patton's written reactions to one of Fuller's books covered 7 pages of single-spaced typed notes. Now, that's a pretty good amount of notes, single-spaced typed notes. Neither was reading the only method in which Patton gained his military expertise. To him, training was the glue that held an army together. Proper training accustomed men to obey orders automatically. Patton knew full well that soldiers could only perform their duties during battlefield conditions when those duties were as second nature to them. As a matter of fact, after the First World War was over, he sat down and he wrote a little piece called The Obligations of Being an Officer. And in that, he expounded upon his views about training and the importance of training. And he figured that when someone is being shot at, if what they're doing is not simply second nature, just like breathing, then when that first shell starts coming over, that person's going to probably cower down in a hole somewhere, and then not only will they lose the battle, but they will sit there in that hole and they'll be killed themselves. And then the battle will be lost and they'll be killed too. So you might as well get up and go do something about it. In the 1920s and 1930s, Patton was working hard and taking his soldiering very seriously. This was quite something for a man who, during the 20s and 30s, the U.S. Army was almost nothing. They had no tanks. They had been cut down to the absolute bare minimum. There were hardly any officer corps to talk about. It was really an amazing feat if you think about what happened later when General Marshall took over as commander of the army and turned around an almost non-existent army into one of the largest armies in the entire history of the world, and did it only within a few months. Very much to the credit of General Marshall to be able to do something like that. But previous to Marshall, Patton knew what had to be done, and he kept working hard because he knew that if something ever happened, whenever opportunity knocks at your door, you have to be ready. And if you're not ready, opportunity knocking is going to be useless. So he wanted to be ready when that happened. As a matter of fact, it turned out that Marshall had a rule that only men 50 years and under would be considered for combat duty. But Patton, because Marshall knew him, was chosen for combat duty even though he was 55 years old at the time. He was the only general officer chosen for combat duty who was at the age of 55, which is interesting to show that Marshall at least knew what Patton was all about. In addition to reading, playing polo, in the 1930s, Patton invented a machine gun sled that would give assault riflemen more direct fire support. He conceived and designed a new saddle pack to increase the range and striking power of cavalry. He worked very closely with J. Walter Christie to improve the silhouette, the suspension, the power, and weapons of tanks. He designed and constructed tank models. He originated plans to reconstruct infantry divisions into a triangular form as opposed to what they call the old square formation. This would allow the army to squeeze more maneuverability and firepower out of far fewer men. As a matter of fact, this triangular division predated the similar World War II reorganization that was formed by General Leslie McNair. Patton continually sought to create more and better mobility in operations. He became an authority on amphibious landings. To better understand airplanes and the role of air power in the war, in the upcoming war, he obtained a pilot's license, taught himself how to fly. He was one of the first to see the importance and flexibility of employing a light airplane for communications and liaisons. He did all of this on his own before the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Although Patton is primarily remembered today as a tank general, hardly anyone remembers the fact that Patton was the leading American amphibious authority in the European theater of operations. His landings in Morocco were the only ones executed by an all-American force. The other two simultaneous landings were conducted by Anglo-American forces. As a matter of fact, at that point in time, he created history because he was in charge of the first American force that ever left the United States by ship and actually landed on and attacked a foreign country. He was the first man to ever do that. Patton's tactics in Sicily became the prototype for subsequent invasions of southern Italy, Anzio, Normandy, and southern France. Interestingly enough, although Patton was not allowed to play a part in invasions following Sicily, he was the one who set the pattern. And although he wasn't often consulted what they would call officially, he was consulted on every invasion unofficially. People were always asking his opinion and always trying to get him to help out, but they would never give him the credit for it. Still another example of his professional expertise was Patton's use of close aircraft support. Throughout the European campaign of World War II, the 19th Tactical Air Command supported Patton's Third Army. Patton both encouraged and promoted the closest possible cooperation between the air and the ground forces. He made sure his ground headquarters and the air headquarters were physically located in close proximity. He encouraged a close-knit working atmosphere between the two staffs. He even went so far as to give them meals together, made them eat together, so they would, knowing that whenever they were eating together, they would talk about work, and they would talk about what needed to be done the next day. He constantly applauded the efforts of the airmen and continually directed the attention of newspaper correspondents to the value and importance of air support. One thing about Patton was that he always enjoyed shocking people. He liked to create the impression that he was impulsive in his decisions, acting as though everything he did was from instinct. Although it might seem that he did indeed have some sort of sixth sense regarding possible enemy action, the simple fact is that he was so imbued with military knowledge, history, and doctrine that everything was already in his mind. All he had to do was to recall it in relationship to whatever the situation currently was. Patton even wrote it down one time. He explained it thusly: by studying history from recorded time until today, when a situation occurs on the battlefield, somewhere in that knowledge, there will be a similar experience. All the general has to do is retrieve the information from his memory and use the current means at hand to inflict the maximum amount of wounds, death, and destruction on the enemy in the minimum amount of time. It's exactly this type of knowledge and perception that enabled him to deploy his forces confidently and with pure audacity. But even for all Patton's knowledge and leadership qualities, underneath his sharp and boldly announced course of action, he always displayed loyalty to and an immense appreciation of the solid, dependable, and reliable work performed by his staff. He knew that his staff was indeed his right and left arm. His staff planned well, and they left little to chance. His staff was always built of men who had personally and been hand-picked by Patton. They were loyal men. Remember the word loyal. Patton, of course, was exceptionally pragmatic. He viewed himself, his virtue, and courage as the ultimate weapon of war. In his words, new weapons are useful in that they add to the repertoire of killing. But be they tank or tomahawk, weapons are only weapons, after all. Wars are fought with weapons, but they are won by men. In 1909, while Patton was still just a plebe at West Point, Patton wrote in his diary, "Do not regard what you do as only a preparation for doing the same thing more fully or better at some later time." He said, "Nothing is ever done twice. There is no next time." This is of special importance and application to war. There is but one time to win a battle or a campaign. It must be won the first time. In order for a man to become a great soldier, it is necessary for him to be so thoroughly conversant with all sorts of military possibilities that whenever an occasion arises, he has at hand, without effort on his part, a parallel. To attain this end, it is necessary for a man to begin to read military history in its earliest and hence crudest form, and to follow it down in natural sequence, permitting his mind to grow with the subject until he can grasp without effort the most abstruse question of the science of war, because he is already permeated with all of its elements. Ultimately, what made it possible for George S. Patton, Jr. to achieve greatness was not just his driving, obsessive willpower. Patton believed in luck, and he was lucky enough to have fate on his side. He was the right man, at the right time, and in the right place. All of the stars must have just been precisely aligned just to bring him to this one point in history. But luck was only a part of it. Patton firmly believed that he had been born for that purpose. As a believer in reincarnation, he felt that this was indeed his fate, forever. He said as much in his poem, perhaps his best and greatest poem. The poem is called "Through a Glass, Darkly." And the last stanza of it is, "So forever in the future shall I battle as of yore, dying to be born a fighter, but to die again once more." Patton's luck, the needs of his nation, and fate all came together in juxtaposition. When opportunity knocked on his door, Patton was ready, he was able, and he was willing. Patton was, in many respects, similar to a diamond. It was hard, multifaceted, and fascinating to look at. George Patton was essentially a warrior. He was a man of action. He was also a man of wit, culture, and knowledge. America was lucky to have him when they needed him.
Now dump him over the side and clear this bridge!
Down, General, is we can't get any air support.
The hell with that. Nobody's getting any air support. If you can't put some fire into this battalion, Colonel, I'll get somebody who can. Major? You the executive officer here?
Yes, sir.
What's your name?
Walker, sir.
Well, you're now the commanding officer. You got 4 hours to break through that beachhead down there. If you don't make it by then, I'll fire you.
There are 50,000 men on this island who'd like to shoot that son of a bitch.
Please take me home. Take me home. Please take me home.
There he goes, old blood and guts.
Yeah, our blood. His guts.
Where are you from, Gomez?
California, sir.
Me too. Where were you hit?
In the chest, sir.
Well, this might be interesting to you, but the last German I saw didn't have any chest. Didn't have any head either. You get well quickly, son.
What's the matter with you?
I guess I just can't take it, sir.
What did you say?
It's my nerves, sir. I just can't stand this yelling anymore.
Your nerves? Well, hell, you're just a goddamn coward. We have a yellow bastard sitting here crying in front of these brave men who've been wounded in battle. Shut up! Don't admit this yellow bastard. Nothing wrong with him. I won't have sons of bitches who are afraid to fight stinking up this place of honor. We're going back to the front, my friend. You may get shot, you may get killed, but you're going up to the fighting. Either that or I'm going to stand you up in front of a firing squad. I ought to shoot you myself, for God's damn. Get him out of here. Send him up to the front. You hear me? You goddamn coward! I won't have cowards in my army.
Butts up there, but Truscott finally broke through to those people on the beach.
Have you seen the casualty list?
Yes, I've seen them. What's the word from the coast road?
Well, the 3rd Division is east of Brolo, heading toward Messina.
Good. Let's get dressed and get over there. I want to go in with the troops.
You go ahead, George. I'm not very good at that.
General Bradley, it's time to consider just how many casualties we'd have if we were still down there crawling along that goddamn road.
Patton, I shan't kiss you.
Pity, because I shaved very close this morning in preparation for getting smacked by you.
Match!
You wanted to see me, George?
Got a letter here for Mike. I was rereading Caesar's commentaries last night. In battle, Caesar wore a red robe to distinguish him from his men. I was struck by that fact because... Despicable. That's the first time in my life anybody ever applied that word to me.
Well, at least it's a personal reprimand. It's not official.
The man was yellow. He should have been tried for cowardice and shot. My God, have they forgotten about all the people who've taken a hell of a lot worse than a little kick in the pants? I ruffled his pride a little bit. What's that compared to war? 2 weeks ago, when we took Palermo, they called me a hero, said I was the greatest general since Stonewall Jackson.
And now they draw cartoons about you.
Dirty bastard. They got me holding a little GI there and kicking him with an iron boot. You see that? What's on my boot? A swastika. On my boot, an iron boot with a swastika. You will apologize to the soldier you slapped. To all doctors and nurses who were present in the tent at the time. To every patient in the tent who can be reached. And last but not least, to the 7th Army as a whole. Through individual units, one at a time. God, I feel low.
O God, thou art my God. Early will I seek thee. My soul thirsteth for thee. My flesh longeth for thee in a dry and thirsty land, so as I have seen thee in the sanctuary. My soul followeth hard after thee. But those that seek my soul to destroy it shall go into the lower parts of the earth. They shall fall by the sword. They shall be a portion for foxes. But the king shall rejoice in God. Everyone that sweareth by him shall glory. But the mouth of them that speak lies shall be stopped.
Stand put! At ease. I thought I would stand up here and let you people see. If I am as big a son of a bitch as some of you think I am. I assure you I had no intention of being either harsh or cruel in my treatment of the soldier in question. My sole purpose was to try to restore in him some appreciation of his obligations as a man and as a soldier. If one can shame a coward, I felt, one might help him to regain his self-respect. This was on my mind. Now, I freely admit that my method was wrong, but I hope you can understand my motive and will accept this explanation and this apology. Dismissed.
Dead put!
Good evening, General. Just want to make a report on a private poll I've been taking.
What poll?
The fan mail. 11% con, 89% pro. And that 11% of protest in most cases is both obscene and anonymous. But the pro letters are mostly from relatives and servicemen. I want you to know that we are proud our son is serving in your army. From the newspaper accounts, we are not clear exactly what you did and why, but we want you to know we are for you. Keep going, and God bless you.
Keep going, huh? Where?
I thought you might like a sip of wine, General. It's New Year's. You didn't celebrate at all last night.
I'm sick of sitting around this royal doghouse. We've taken Sicily. I'm ready for a new assignment.
Well, maybe you've got it. Here's a radio message just came in.
God, I've been relieved. They've relieved me from command of the 7th Army.
I don't believe it.
Happy New Year.
Just a minute, sir. Since they're sure to give you another command, isn't it logical that they'd relieve you here first?
You mean command of all the American troops going into Europe? It's a possibility. I know it's been discussed from time to time.
Well, the logic of it is so obvious, it couldn't mean anything else. Sir, I'm going to open this bottle of wine.
Now, Sicard, but if you find a bottle of cognac and open it, I'll help you drink.
How are you feeling tonight, General?
Not bad. Not bad at all. Get me some writing there, will you, George?
Yes, sir.
Your wife ever give you the devil for not writing?
All the time, sir. Only I don't write as often as you do. Don't seem to get around to it.
Lucky thing for us, we got him, huh? Who wants to marry a couple of broken-down old horse cattle?
That's what my wife says to me every time I come home, sir.
What are you doing up so late, George?
Just thought you might like a nice hot bath or a glass of milk or something. I got the sleeping pill from the doctor, just in case you might need it.
Sleeping pill? What's going on here, anyway?
Well, I heard the news tonight, sir. They announced it on the radio.
What news?
It's about General Bradley, sir. How they gave him the top American command for the invasion.
Oh. Yeah.
Well, I just thought you might be feeling kind of low, sir. Writing things, sir, here on the desk, sir.
Yeah. Thank you, George.
One little dog face. One measly little slap. That's what done.
Oh, George. I wish I'd kissed the son of a bitch.
Nous rendons hommage aux superbes forces de la France libre, munies par le général de Gaulle et le général Leclerc.
Paying tribute to the free French forces under de Gaulle and Leclerc.
Les héros, hommes et femmes de la résistance, qui risquent leur vie chaque jour pour vaincre le Bosch.
Also to the brave men and women of the resistance who risk their lives every day to help destroy the Germans.
La France pour le bien de la libre. Je vous entends ma parole.
France will be free again, I give you my word.
Tout comme les troupes de la France libre, on débarque ici en Corse pour libérer la terre natale de Napoléon. Je débarquerai bientôt en France et t'aiderai à la libération de la terre natale de Lafayette.
Just as free French troops landed here in Corsica to liberate the birthplace of Napoleon, I will someday land in France to help liberate the birthplace of Lafayette. General, the reporters would like a word with you.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
General Patton, can you tell us something about the purpose of this visit to Corsica?
I was ordered here by General Eisenhower.
It was reported that you wrote the mother of the boy who slapped saying, the yellow rat should have been shot. Is that true, General?
No comment.
Sir, I understand General Alexander suggested that you take over General Mark Clark's Italian campaign. But the War Department killed that because of the slapping incident.
No comment.
Can you tell us where you're going, sir?
General Eisenhower has ordered me to Malta, but that's off the record. Interview concluded.
You plan on slapping any soldiers there, General?
Malta?
Jawohl, General Lewis.
Malta als Basis. Und dann Südgriechenland. Das ist möglich. Geben Sie mir Generalfeldmarschall Keitel.
In 1528, these forts were defended by 400 knights of Malta and 800 mercenaries against a force of 40,000 Turks. Oh, Cotman.
Still no word from General Eisenhower?
No, sir.
Not even any response about those two turkeys I sent him for Christmas?
No, sir.
Go ahead, gentlemen. Take a closer look for yourselves. Looks as if you boys have hitched your wagon to a fallen star. Pass the word. If anybody wants out, I'll understand.
Sir, I can speak to the entire staff. We want to stay with you, no matter what duty you're assigned to.
Up in London, they're planning the invasion of Europe. That's what I've trained my whole mind, body, and spirit for. What in God's name am I doing here? All right. Let's get on to Cairo. See if the pyramids are still standing.
Es gibt nur einen einzigen Grund, warum er in Kairo ist. Um mit den griechischen und jugoslawischen Exilregierungen zu verhandeln. Verdammt nochmal, sollen die Italiener Italien verteidigen. Es ist ja schließlich ihr Land. Wir brauchen unsere Truppen auf Kreta und an der griechischen Küste, um unsere Einheiten dort zu verstärken, falls Fetten von Ägypten aus Lust schlägt.
Herr Generalovers, ich habe neue Informationen. Patton steht in Kreuzfeuer strenger Kritik. Es besteht sogar die Möglichkeit, dass er vor ein Kriegsgericht gestellt wird. Er hat einen Soldaten geohrfeigt.
Steiger, glauben Sie denn wirklich alles, was Sie in Ihren Zeitungen schreiben? Sie werden gerade Ihren besten Kommandeur opfern, weil er einen Muschkoten geohrfeigt hat.
This place is for me?
Yes, sir. This way, sir.
Whoever found it has a genius for cloak and dagger. Who picked this cat out?
I believe it was General Smith, sir.
He did it to spite me, son of a bitch.
Welcome to London, George.
There you go. How are you?
Is Zach here? He asked me to brief you. Would you excuse us, please? First, let me put you straight about Ike. We hear a lot about you criticizing his decisions.
Nah, not really, Bill. You know me. I'm just an old fool. Sometimes I do wonder whether he isn't a limey at heart.
George, this is the toughest coalition ever attempted in history. Ike sits at the top, trying to hold it together and lick the Germans at the same time. Now, believe me, it's one hell of a job.
I appreciate that.
Now, we have an important assignment for you in connection with the Normandy invasion.
Good. Now, I've studied the Overlord plan, and it has a number of flaws in it. Not the least of which is its dependency on Monty taking Caen by D-Day. He'll never make it. Now, I've drawn up an alternate plan which calls for a landing at Calais following an air bombardment.
Please, will you just listen for a change? Remember, I stood by you when everyone, and I mean everyone, wanted Patton with a rope around his neck. We're going to let it leak out that you are here undercover, that you're preparing to invade at the Pas de Calais. We hope to pin down the German 15th Army there so they can't be used against us at Normandy.
Then all you people think I'm good for?
We're going to build an army of 12 divisions around you. All fictitious, of course. Dummy troop concentrations, dummy landing craft, simulated radio traffic. You see, the Germans are convinced that you are going to lead the main invasion effort. Their agents will spot you here before long, then we can move you to your new headquarters at Knutsford.
What do I do there?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Frankly, George, you're on probation. If you take my advice, you'll behave yourself. Remember, your worst enemy is your own big mouth.
Nasty face, son of a bitch, Captain. Bread for combat. I'm going to call him William, but William the combat.
General, maybe you want to leave me in the car.
Sorry. Good afternoon, lady.
Good afternoon.
What's this guy?
General, he'll kill that dog.
Now, hold it.
I'm terribly sorry, General. Did Abigail frighten your dog?
That's quite all right.
This way, sir.
Your name isn't William. It's Willie.
My dear friend, General George S. Patton, Jr. has accepted our invitation to say a few words to you on the occasion of this inaugural ceremony. Patton is not here in an official capacity, and I have assured him most earnestly that nothing he says will be quoted. May I present General Patton?
Thank you.
Remember, sir, watch your language.
Yeah.
My dear ladies, until today, my only experience at welcoming has been to welcome Germans and Italians to the infernal region. At this, I have been quite successful, since the troops which I've had the honor to command have to date killed or captured some 170,000 of our enemies. I feel that such clubs as these are of very real value, because I believe with Mr. Bernard Shaw that the British and the Americans are two peoples separated by a common language. And since it is the evident destiny of the British and Americans to rule the world, the better we know each other, the better we will do it.
The Russians. Don't forget the Russians.
I think that a club like this is an ideal place for promoting mutual understanding. Because as soon as our soldiers meet and get to know the English ladies and write home and tell our women just how lovely you truly are, then the sooner the American ladies will get jealous and force this war to a quick termination. Then I will get a chance to go to the Pacific and kill Japanese.
In cities all over the nation, mass meetings are held to protest General George Patton's statement that Britain and America will rule the post-war world, that Russia will have nothing to say. Congressional leaders like Senator Claiborne Foss are quick to react.
This man has insulted our Russian allies, implying Anglo-American world rule. In my opinion, he should be severely disciplined.
No, Beetle. This time I didn't do a damn thing. They promised me there wouldn't be any reporters there. All I did was make a few remarks off the record.
I told you to keep your mouth shut. You wouldn't listen. Don't you realize how suspicious the Russians are, the British and ourselves?
I was only trying to be polite to the old ladies. If there'd been any Russians there, I would have mentioned them. I don't like the sons of bitches, but I would have mentioned them out of politeness. Beetle, I don't know anything about politics. You know that. I have no political ambitions after the war. All I want to do is to command an army in combat.
Well, it's out of our hands now. I sent a message last night to the chief of staff. So now it's up to General Marshall to decide whether you stay here as a decoy or he sends you home.
Well, he's a good man. At least he's a fair man. I'll let it sit with him.
Destined to achieve some great thing, what I don't know. But this last incident is so trivial in its nature and so terrible in its effect, it can't be the result of an accident. It has to be the work of God. The last great opportunity of a lifetime, an entire world at war, and I'm left out of it? God will not permit this to happen. I am going to be allowed to fulfill my destiny. His will be done.
largest amphibious operation ever attempted. A pre-dawn naval bombardment prepares the way for Allied soldiers to assault the Normandy beaches and claw out a desperate foothold on the continent of Europe.
I knew Montgomery couldn't take Con on D-Day or D-plus 10. And I said so. And here they are, all hung up in the hedgerow country. What they should do now is pivot the way von Schlieffen planned it in the First World War. Then we might get a chance to do some real broken field running. All right, they don't listen to me. What a way to enter the continent of Europe, huh? Along with all the rest of the spare parts.
Everything on this plane is high priority. General Bradley wouldn't send for you unless he had something in mind.
Well, I'll tell you, Cod, I've learned my lesson. If I ever do get another chance, I'm going to keep my mouth shut. I'm going to play the game. If I forget, you remind me.
I'll give you a gentle nudge in the ribs.
Give me a swift kick in the ass.
Yes, sir.
Welcome to France, sir.
I hope the war's still on, Hanson. Where's the boss?
Right this way, sir.
Haven't seen you since Messina.
General, how are you?
I hear you're doing a splendid job decoying the Jervis. Well, you'll forgive me. I'm off for the front. Bless you everything, eh, boy. By the way, intelligence confirms that I'm against Wommel again.
Rommel.
Hi, how are you, George?
Pretty fair, Brad. How are you?
Fine.
My, isn't this plush? Looks like you're bucking for Archbishop.
Well, Chet Hansen had this rig built for me. George said, Ike wanted me to talk to you. I told him that you and I could level with each other.
That's right.
We're going to make Third Army operational as soon as I can take over 12th Army Group.
Did I get it?
I'll be honest with you. I've had reservations.
Well, you've been my senior ever since I left the academy. You were the boss in North Africa and Sicily, and I just thought, well, it might be a problem for the both of us. Wouldn't bother me.
There's one other thing. I don't want to hit this one too hard, but we're different kinds of people, George.
You're right, Brad. God damn it, you're always right. With your brains and my screwy ideas, we'll make a wonderful team. We proved that in Sicily.
I tell you the truth, if I'd been your senior in Sicily, I would have relieved you.
Brad, I'm crawling my belly to get a command. For God's sake, you've got to get me in this fight. The only way I can get out of the doghouse is to do something spectacular. I've got to get back in the war. My God, Hitler's own people tried to kill him a couple of days ago. First thing you know, it'll all be over and... I'll keep my mouth shut. I'll behave myself. I give you my word.
George, I've been working on a plan called Cobra. I'd like to know what you think of it.
Now, we've been slugging our way through hedgerow country half an acre a day, and we've got to find a way to break out. I want to use this road, the San Lopierre Road. We'll let Monty pin down the enemy forces at Cannes. We'll pulverize an area 3.5 miles wide with saturation bombing, and then 7 divisions will follow through. The Third Army will swing around here, a sweeping end run right across France. What do you think?
I think you need a screwball old horse cavalryman to command Third Army. George,
Ike came to that conclusion in London 3 months ago.
He what? Well, that dirty... I'm sorry. I promise to keep my mouth shut.
Was macht der Feind bei Kutung? Feindliche Panzertruppen durchbrechen unsere Verteidigungsstellungen bei Lessay. Amerikanische Panzereinheiten stoßen mit hoher Geschwindigkeit in die rückwärtigen Gebiete vor.
Was sagen wir, General Pettenschall? Aber das hört sich sehr nach Petten an.
Petten ist doch in England.
Wissen wir das genau? Die Landung in der Normandie war nur ein Täuschungsmanöver. Die Invasion wird sich bei Calais abspielen, und zwar unter Petten. Der Führer hat angeordnet, dass die 15. Armee unter keinen Umständen in die Normandie verlegt wird. Ja, die Männer der 15. Armee sitzen am Strandstrand von Calais und spielen mit Kieselstein, während unsere Soldaten in der Normandie abgeschlachtet werden.
Die 15. Armee erwartet Petten bei Calais. Da wird er auch landen, in Calais.
Sie bringen es offenbar fertig, diesen Unsinn unwidersprochen hinzunehmen, Jode. Warum?
Weil ich nicht darauf aus bin, dem Führer zu widersprechen.
George would at least have the courtesy to let us know where he's going.
Good God, look at that. Where you going, General?
Berlin! I'm going to personally shoot that paper-hanging son of a bitch!
George a headline, and he's good for another 30 miles.
All right, now look, let's pay attention. We're going to clean this mess up right now. Let's move this vehicle out this way. This one out this way. Back that thing up there. And we'll take this one here. All right, get up above your ass. Let's go now. That's it. That's the way to move. Good boy. All right, come on. Come on now. Here we go. Come on. That's it. That's it. Gun it. Gun that thing. Okay, come on. Watch it. Go, go, go. Come on. Hold it up. Come on, baby. Yeah, yeah. Come on. That's it. Come on now. Yes, yes. Come on. Keep coming. Keep coming. Hold it up there. Now, come on. Hold it. Hey, dummy. Hold the friggin' thing. Nice. That's it. Come on. Good boy. Hold it up there.
General. General Bradley wants to have a word with you. Down right there.
Okay. Come on. Okay. Hold it up. Here it goes.
George, you'd make a good traffic cop. George, this drive to the Zane has been absolutely magnificent, but I'm sorry to say I'm going to have to slow you down.
What the hell for?
Well, for the time being, we're going to have to cut off your supplies. Gasoline, ammunition, everything. Shape is up against a new set of priorities.
I think I smell Montgomery.
Oh, now, take it easy, George. There are serious issues involved here, political issues.
My God, it is Montgomery.
The launching sites for the V-2 bombs are all in his area. Mr. Churchill wants those rocket bases destroyed. Hitler's killing more civilians in London than he is soldiers in the field.
They expect Montgomery to do anything about it? You give me that gasoline and I'll gain ground with it. I'll kill Germans, too. Give me 400,000 gallons, I'll go to Berlin.
George, I can't do it.
Brad, the Siegfried line is an empty shell. They stripped all the equipment, sent it to Eastern Front. It's overgrown and crawling with cows. I could punch through it in 2 days.
Now, there's no use arguing with me. It wasn't my idea.
If you won't let me kill the enemy, why did you pick me to command?
I didn't pick you. Ike picked you. George, you have performed brilliantly. You are loyal, dedicated. You're one of the best field commanders I've got, but you don't know when to shut up. George, you're a pain in the neck.
I have a lot of faults, Brad. But ingratitude isn't one of them. I owe you a lot. Hell, I know I'm a prima donna. I admit it. What I can't stand about Monty is he won't admit it.
Run out of gas. The point tank has run out too. And there's a curb column up ahead.
Yeah, I know.
Thank you.
command here, Captain?
I was in command. My tank platoon was supporting an infantry company. Tanks ran out of gas, so we had to fight it out. We started at 11 o'clock last night. Finished a couple hours ago. This morning, the fighting was hand to hand.
Dream last night. In my dream, it came to me that right now the whole Nazi Reich is mine for the taking. Think about that, God. I was nearly sent home in disgrace. Now I have precisely the right instrument at precisely the right moment of history in exactly the right place.
The Tsar?
This will change, too, very quickly. Like a planet spinning off into the universe. A moment like this won't come again for 1,000 years, and all I need is a few miserable gallons of gasoline. Right now, the weak spot is here. In 10 days, we could be in Berlin.
What about the fortifications in Verdun and Metz?
Fixed fortifications are monuments to the stupidity of man. Now, when mountain ranges and oceans could be overcome, anything built by man can be overcome. You know how I'm sure they're finished out there? The carts. They're using carts to move their wounded and their supplies. The carts came to me in my dream. They kept buzzing around in my head. I couldn't figure it out. Then I remembered. A nightmare in the snow, the endless, agonizing retreat from Moscow. How cold it was. They took the wounded and what was left of the supplies and threw in the carts. Napoleon was finished. Not any color left, not even the red of blood. Only the snow. Look at this cart. I love it. God help me, I do love it so. I love it more than my life.
Is liberated, and French troops lead the way. The Allies march into the historic city after 4 years of Nazi occupation. The hard-fighting French 2nd Armored Division, under Major General Jacques Leclerc, gets a welcome they will never forget as they enter their beloved Paris. In a powerful drive to the north, British General Montgomery cuts off and bypasses the French coastal towns of Boulogne, Calais, and Dunkirk, pushing on to capture the vital Belgian port of Antwerp. Meanwhile, the main body of Patton's army, resupplied now and rolling like a juggernaut, is slashing toward the Tsar. Nazi resistance appears to be crumbling, and it seems that nothing can stop our troops from driving on into the heart of Germany.
Sir, General Bradley, on your line.
Good.
Listen, I've got a bridgehead across the Saar. I'm on my way into Germany.
Wait a minute, George. There's a lot of trouble up north. Now, listen, I want you to transfer 10th Armored to Middleton's 8th Corps right away.
Now, Brad, you can't do that.
George, now listen, I don't have time to argue. There's a lot of enemy activity up around our dens. No, I don't know how serious it is, but Ike wants us to meet with Beadle Smith tomorrow at Verdun. Be there at 1100.
Yes, sir.
No reason for us to assume that the Germans are mounting a major offensive. The weather is awful. The supplies are low. The German army hasn't mounted a winter attack since Frederick the Great. Therefore, I believe that's exactly what they're going to do. Contingency plans for pulling out of our eastward attack, changing directions 90 degrees, moving up to Luxembourg. Don't look so stunned, gentlemen. I want you to plan for 3 possible axes of attack. From Dunkirk, due north. From Arlon to Bastogne. From Neufchâteau against the German left flank.
Identified 4 German armies, the 7th, 5th Panzer, 6th SS Panzer, and the 15th. They've hit us with 26 divisions. They overran 2 regiments of the 106th Division, and 7,500 of our men were forced to surrender. Our immediate concern is that von Rundstedt has the 101st Airborne trapped here, at Bastogne.
Bastogne, by the way, is the key to this entire area. If we can hold it, we can break up the entire German offensive. If they take it, we're in serious trouble. Ike wants to know if anybody can get up there and relieve the 101st before they're torn to pieces.
I'm afraid there's nothing that Field Marshal Montgomery can do. Anyway, not for some weeks.
What about you, George?
I can attack with 3 divisions in 48 hours.
Well, I'd give myself some leeway if I were you.
Ike wants a realistic estimate, George. You're in the middle of a fight now, and it's over 100 miles to Bastogne.
My staff's already working on the details.
Well, frankly, I don't see how it's possible. Not in this kind of weather.
I should have thought you'd want to fall back and regroup.
Not me, Freddy. I don't like to pay for the same real estate twice.
But what about your men? You can't pull them out of the line and cart them up 100 miles and then expect them to attack without rest.
I train these men, Arthur. They'll do what I tell them to do.
Perhaps we hadn't realized that you were quite so popular with your troops, General.
I'm not. They'll do it because they're good soldiers. And because they realize, as I do, that we can still lose this war.
Well, I think I can speak for Field Marshal Montgomery. He'd say you're asking the impossible of your men.
Of course he would. But he's never realized that that's what we're in business for.
McAuliffe turned down a German surrender demand. You know what he said?
What?
He said nuts.
Keep moving, Colonel. A man that eloquent has to be saved. Pays off. The training and the discipline. No other outfit in the world. Pull out of a winter battle, move 100 miles, go into a major attack with no rest, no sleep, no hot food. God, I'm proud of these men.
Another Panzer division against Bristol. The 1st Air Force holding on by its fingernails.
Damn, the air cover's what we need. If we had 24 hours of decent weather, we might make it.
General Mason, sir.
Mace. Listen, we're short on foot soldiers. I want you to cannibalize your anti-aircraft units and turn them all into riflemen. Yes, every damn last one of you can find.
Evening, General. I just got the weather report for tomorrow. More snow.
There goes our air cover. Sir, we may have to pull up and wait for better weather. Brave men dying up there. I'm not going to wait. Not an hour. Not a minute.
It's going to keep moving. Is that clear? We're going to attack all night. We're going to attack tomorrow morning. If we're not victorious, let no one come back alive.
You know something, General? Sometimes they can't tell when you're acting and when you're not.
It isn't important for them to know. It's only important for me to know.
You want to see me, General?
Oh, yes, Chaplain. I'm sick and tired of Third Army having to fight the Germans. The Supreme Command, no gasoline. And now this ungodly weather. I want a prayer, a weather prayer.
Weather prayer, sir?
Yes, let's see if you can't get God working with us in this thing.
It's going to take a pretty thick rug for that kind of praying.
I don't care if it takes a flying carpet.
Well, I don't know how this is going to be received, General. Praying for good weather so we can kill our fellow man.
Well, I can assure you, sir, because of my intimate relations with the Almighty, if you write a good prayer, we'll have good weather. I expect that prayer within an hour.
Yes, sir.
Almighty and most merciful Father, we humbly beseech thee, of thy great goodness, to restrain this immoderate weather with which we've had to contend. Grant us fair weather for battle. Graciously hearken to us as soldiers who call upon thee, that armed with thy power, we may advance from victory to victory and crush the oppression and wickedness of our enemies and establish thy justice among men and nations. Amen. That chaplain. He stands in good with the Lord, and I want to decorate
and fighter bombers, which fly countless sorties against German positions, elements of the Third Army, spearheaded by the 4th Armored Division, drive into the besieged city of Bastogne to relieve its 18,000 defenders on the day after Christmas.
During this operation, Third Army moved farther and faster and engaged more divisions in less time than any other army in the history of the United States.
This is the same.
Weilen Sie sich, Steiger, vernichten Sie alles. Hab Ihre Karten, alles, was hier rumliegt.
Wird alles vernichtet werden, da können Sie ganz sicher sein, Herr Generaloberst.
Nur nicht den Russen in die Hände fallen. Dann mache ich selbst Schluss mit der Führer in seinem Bunker.
Auch hier wird zugrunde gehen. Tatsache, dass es keinen Krieg mehr gibt. Den Umfeld. Leib und Seele fällt, Herr. Großartiger Anachronismus.
Would like to know whether you will join him to drink to the surrender of Germany.
My compliments to the general. Please inform him that I do not care to drink with him or any other Russian son of a bitch.
Sir, I cannot tell the general that.
You tell him that. Tell him word for word.
Он говорит так точно. Не то, что с вами не буду выпивать, но ни с каким русским сыком сыном.
Он тоже сукин сын.
Скажите. The general says he thinks that you are a son of a bitch too.
Okay. I'll drink to that. One son of a bitch to another.
One strasbourg. Хочу будет пить. Один сукин сын до другого.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
General, is it true that President Roosevelt, before he died, promised you a combat command in the Pacific?
Yes, he did, but now that he's gone, I don't think there's much chance of that. Doug MacArthur doesn't want me up there.
We've been told about these wonder weapons the Germans were working on. Long-range rockets, push-button bombing, weapons that don't need soldiers.
Wonder weapons? Thank God I don't see the wonder in them. Killing without heroics, nothing is glorified, nothing is reaffirmed. No heroes, no cowards, no troops, no generals. Only those who are left alive and those who are left dead. I'm glad I won't live to see it.
It's been pointed out, General, that you're still using former Nazis in key positions, despite the official denazification policy.
Well, if I'm supplied with trained personnel, I'll get rid of the Nazis. Until then, I'll use the people who can run the railroads and keep the telephones working.
After all, General, didn't most ordinary Nazis join the party in about the same way Americans become Republicans or Democrats?
Yes, that's about it.
You do agree, don't you, General, that our national policy should be made by civilians and not by the military?
Of course I agree. But the politicians never let us finish. They always stop short and leave us with another war to fight.
You thinking about our Russian allies?
Sir, did you say if you found your army between the Germans and the Russians, you'd attack in both directions?
No, I never said that. I never said any such thing. But I wish I had.
Sir, there's a call on your line from Supreme Headquarters, General Smith.
Beetle?
Ike is furious. How could you possibly compare the Republicans and Democrats to the Nazi Party? And this statement that you refuse to denazify has everybody screaming, the Russians, the British, everybody.
Well, the hell with the mongoloid Russians. We've given them Berlin, we've given them Prague, God knows what else. Are they going to let them dictate policy, too?
George, don't be a fool. The war in Europe is over. Washington dictates policy.
Well, the war shouldn't be over, and we should stop pussyfooting about the goddamn Russians. We're going to have to fight them sooner or later anyway. Why not do it now when we've got the army here to do it with? Instead of disarming these German troops, we ought to get them to help us fight the damn Bolsheviks.
George, you better shut up. This line may be tapped.
Well, I don't give a damn if it is. I'll tell you something, Beetle. Up until now, we've been fighting the wrong people. Look, you and I don't have to get involved. You're so damn soft about it. You leave it to me. In 10 days, I'll have us at war with those sons of bitches, and I'll make it look like their fault.
George, you're mad. You're absolutely out of your mind.
Well, I'm no diplomat. I'm a combat soldier. That's all these jokers understand. You get Ike to give me the word, and I'll kick their behinds back into Russia where they belong.
Shall I call the artist back, sir?
Oh, the hell with it. Nobody wants to see a picture of me. I'm mad. Don't you know that?
Field Marshal Montgomery, His Majesty is prepared to receive the next Chief of the Imperial General Staff.
Thank you, Robin. Take care of yourself, Grum. George. Well, gentlemen, all good things must come to an end. And the best thing that's happened to me in my life has been, the honor and privilege of commanding the Third Army. Goodbye. And God bless you. They've taken the Third Army away from me. I know. I just thought we could have dinner together tonight. Thank you. Red, it's damn thoughtful. I appreciate it.
Right now, I think I'm going to take Willie for a walk. Been through. Imagine getting killed by an ox. Oh, Brad, there's only one proper way for a professional soldier to die. That's from the last bullet of the last battle of the last war. At least the Third Army earned its pay. In our drive across Europe, we liberated 12,000 cities and towns, inflicted 1.5 million enemy casualties.
I have a feeling that from now on, just being a good soldier won't mean a thing. I'm afraid we're going to have to be diplomats, administrators, you name it.
God help us.
George, I want to say one thing. You've done a magnificent job here in Europe. That's right, George. I think that soldier you slapped back there in Sicily did more to win the war than any other private in the army.
I'll see you for dinner.
6:30?
Roman conquerors returning from the wars enjoyed the honor of a triumph, a tumultuous parade. In the procession came trumpeters and musicians and strange animals from the conquered territories, together with carts laden with treasure and captured armaments. The conqueror rode in a triumphal chariot, the dazed prisoners walking in chains before him. Sometimes his children, robed in white, stood with him in the chariot or rode the trace horses. A slave stood behind the conqueror, holding a golden crown and whispering in his ear a warning that all glory is fleeting.